You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Judith Sears. Poisson. Coming up, Act 10, Right to Work, John Doe investigations, and a presidential run. Those are just some of the things that happened during Governor Walker's 8 years in office. We'll look back at his legacy coming up.
First, the famous Wisconsin idea says that the boundaries of our university system should be the boundaries of the state, and its work should benefit everyone. But a lot of people in Wisconsin and around the country feel that the academic world isn't holding up its end of the bargain.
That, combined with the denial of science by some high-profile politicians, has strained the relationship between higher education and the public. Our next guest says that rebuilding some of that trust is critical for the health of our economy and democracy.
Linda Stamato is the co-director of the Center for Negotiation and Conflict Resolution and a faculty member at the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Be happy to be in Wisconsin.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Linda, first of all, how would you assess the relationship between the general public and the academic world in 2018?
Well, I think there is a certain distance have been created really over the last several decades, building, I'd say, from the 70s. While people regard their universities highly by and large and want their children to attend college and university, there seems to be a growing skepticism of some of the work that's done there. But my sense of it is that a lot of that is driven by forces that are not pleased with the results of some of the research that take place, particularly when it comes to climatology, the environment, and public health. So I think they've got forces that have an interest and creating a conflict of interest and therefore undermining the public support for higher education. But I also think sometimes we're our own worst enemies, because there has been historically, I would say, a reluctance to, if I can use the word, translate research into more publicly accessible forms. And so a lot of the research that is done at colleges and universities don't reach the public in the way that it should, so that they don't really quite understand the quality and the importance of some of the work is being done. And I think we're also seeing less and less of academic researchers in the halls of legislatures and on television and in other public media. And instead we have, you know, Twitter and public other social media, which is exactly the best forum for discussing ideas that have to do with vaccines or climate change. So I think a number of things are contributing to it. But I'd say, Darrell, that really what we need to do is lessen that distance and gain greater respect across the divide. But I think it'll take both sides of the equation to focus on that.
Why do you think it's so important to have a trusting relationship between the public and academia?
Well, because I think we need verifiable facts, we need evidence we can trust, and we need to be sure that the policies we are following and the laws we're trying to pass and implement are based on something that's more than opinion. Basically, you know, it seems to me that we would like to believe that the surgeon that's operating on us knows what he or she is doing. I don't think we typically question that, and I don't think we question results of work in chemical experiments or in physics or even our ophthalmologist. But somehow or another, all of a sudden, we're worried about the people who work in the area of vaccines and the climate. You know, and why is that? I think because if you look at where the primary lobbyists are operating, it's in those areas. And so I think you have, an effort to raise skepticism where it's not merited, and it's not being resisted strongly enough. Actually, some of the things I've seen and some of my colleagues I've talked to, when they say they try to make themselves accessible to the public, you know, then when write, say, opinion columns or try to write in more accessible language so it's understandable to the general public, they are trolled by, if trolled is now a verb, criticized by people right and left for asserting their expertise as if expertise is somehow or another now a fault. So, I mean, I think those of us who have earned PhDs do think that it should mean something. And maybe that doesn't mean our views and our results shouldn't be contested. We need to be able to prove that what results we've produced are duplicative, but are duplicated by others, and that's the scientific method. But by and large, you know, I guess there's always that certain lack of certitude. You know, if we say that a vaccine is 97% effective, I mean, to me, that's a compelling figure. To someone else who may be less informed, they'd say, well, what about that 3%? So, you know, you got to figure out how you go about balancing what you need in order to understand the decision you should make. But now, when we have every reason to believe in the results of the effectiveness of most vaccines, there's a growing skepticism of them. In New Jersey, for example, we've just had an outbreak of 800 cases of measles when we haven't had anything close to that in decades. And why? Because some time ago there was a study that linked measles vaccine with autism. It's been disproven, but nonetheless, it is still active, live, and being shared on the internet. And as a result, if people want to use that as the source of their information for evidence and support, you know, they're going to reach the wrong conclusion. So it seems to me, you know, at least get four or five different takes on something before you reach a decision that may affect the life of your child and the public's health as well.
Linda, there are a lot of people that may see the world of higher education as elitist or isolated. Do you personally see any truth to that?
Well, you know, I think especially when we're talking about public university systems, when you think about this, since 1860, in the 60s, the Morrill Act, when Abraham Lincoln and Justin Morrill said, this is what we need to do for this nation, we need to create land-grant universities, and Wisconsin's one of them, and so is Rutgers. I mean, this was an effort to say we need something more than the education of chaplains, you know, in a very elite system of higher education, and that's largely what they created, and they weren't really very open to women or to African Americans at all then. So now we have this expanded system. I think the land-grant heritage, particularly its agricultural roots, has been widely respected and supported by the public. And I think, by and large, that tends to continue. I think what's happened is a general distrust that is fed by, well, conflicts of interest from the fossil fuel industry and a couple of others, but in my way of looking at this, it may not be widely known, but in 1971, Lewis Powell, who this was before he ascended to the United States Supreme Court, he was asked by the Chamber of Commerce to develop a blueprint to seek the ascendance of the business community because the Chamber of Commerce seemed to think business was under attack. And he wrote this several-page memorandum, which was written in 1971, as I said, but you read it now and you say, good grief, this sounds like it was written yesterday. And basically says, the fault for all of this anti-business attitude is the college campuses. Those intellectuals are the ones that are responsible. They're questioning the value of business, and they're supporting regulation. They're doing all of these anti-American things. We've got to fight back. And as I look at that memo and think about how it has now played out, the chamber became very active. There are a number of groups that created very corporate, pro-corporate think tanks on various college campuses, and there was a concerted effort to attack universities as somehow or another this liberal bastion that was against business. Now, I mean, it just sounds like so cliched, but I think that notion has prevailed, and it's been fed over time by those who are against regulation because it hurts their interests. And yet, I'm sure most citizens really do want clean air and clean water. And when they say they're against regulation, they're really against dumb or excessive regulations, not smart, essential ones that protect the medicines they take and the air that they breathe. But, you know, I mean, it's very hard to prove a negative. As a matter of fact, it really can't be done. So what do you have to do? You have to keep talking about the value of what you offer and justify the support of the public for the services you deliver, and to graduate students who can lead productive lives in the world and also are active citizens. So, you know, but I think most people seem to think that somehow or another, if you major in chemistry, you're going to come out liberal. I don't know that any, I mean, it may be that a chemist is a Democrat or a Republican, but I can't see how that enters into the periodic table. So I'd say that, and oh, by the way, Ronald, I just saw a recent survey by Pew that said that most students come into college fairly liberal and they graduate more moderate. So, I mean, that's the opposite of what people would tend to think if you ask them, but that's what's happening. So there's a need for some greater understanding of what it is we're doing and what it is we're hoping we deserve the public support for. I think it's our responsibility, as well as it is those who are making the kinds of comments about a higher education they're making and basically undercutting its essential purpose. I think I was looking at some of the congressional hearings and some of the hearings that are done in state legislatures, and there are less and less academic researchers appearing and more lobbyists.
We're talking with Linda Stamato, co-director of the Center for Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at Rutgers University, and we're looking at the relationship between the public and academia.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you aren't currently working or studying in higher education, do you see the work of universities as worthwhile? Why or why not? What do you think academics could do better to relate to people off campus? If you do research or teach at a university, have you faced criticism of your work? How do you or your colleagues respond? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Linda Stamato of Rutgers University, digging into the relationship between academia and the general public.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If you work in higher education, do you think academics could do a better job of communicating with the public? What do you want skeptics of your work to know? And if you're not in the academic world, how do you see the role of universities? If you don't think they're doing enough, how can they improve? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Linda, my apologies for cutting you off, but we were up against the break. But I wanted to continue this conversation and ask you, you know, what can scholars do to break the perception of higher education being isolated or elitist and connect on a more meaningful level with people that aren't a part of the university?
You know, that's an excellent question. You know, I think there's a lot of continuing education program opportunities for people, you know, to check in, you know, at no cost to understand what's going on in areas of their interest. And so I think that's one way. I think they could reach into the community through local education programs, make themselves available as speakers on topics that might be of interest to people in the community, whether it's, you know, the current, the most noted climate report that just came out recently, or on any subject at all. It seems to me adult schools, for example, is another option. Religious groups that gathered and have topical talks on things of interest to them, or even garden clubs. You know, it seems to me there are a variety of options in communities where scholars can have their presence known, and it's a challenge for them to be able to talk in ways with community members about their needs, their interests, their concerns, and in fact, even general questions about what's the value of higher education. We know, we see that students who graduate with degrees tend to earn more over their life course than those without them, but what else does it mean? What does it mean in terms of quality of life and perspective, and what does it have to do with civic engagement to the extent that we care about our communities, our states, our nation? You know, how engaged are we? Another concern sometimes of people is that there's not enough civic education going on, not only in colleges, but in high schools as well. what's their view on that, and how can we help? I think there need to be more conversations with the public and academics about what they'd like to see their colleges doing in their communities, not just helping us, you know, combat mosquitoes and so forth through our land grant programs, but really more expansive. What is philosophy and history and sociology, in fact, chemistry and physics? What can that offer? So that's I'd like to see greater outreach, but I'd also like to see colleges making themselves more accessible on campus and off to the public.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Ben in Beloit. Ben, welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'd like to bring up something from a slightly different point of view about some of the things that are making it difficult for the public to properly appreciate things, particularly in science and its method. I just remember that, you know, these days, for example, if you look at school libraries, particularly at the elementary and secondary level in large urban systems, it's very hard to actually have a real honest-to-God librarian there who's teaching the concept of what's called source authentication at the elementary and secondary level, because that's like that's a fundamental thing of how do you know that what you're reading or talking about or thinking about is from someone who's authoritative? If that concept isn't brought to somebody very early on, I mean, they could conceivably choose to look at the fact that anybody who's in a public medium is an authority because they don't have a critical capacity to look carefully at that question. Another thing is that within the academy itself, unfortunately, there is a problem, particularly from the modern humanities and social sciences, with an assault on the idea that human beings can actually achieve objectivity. In other words, that they're capable of setting aside their biases in the service of finding objective truth. Many of the philosophical approaches and other methods end up working strongly against that. I think that, you know, that's sort of a couple, I think, of some very basic things that I never hear really addressed when talking about these kinds of questions.
Thanks so much for the call, Ben. What are your thoughts on Ben's statement about librarians, Linda?
Okay, let me just say one thing for Gail. Okay, let's talk about the librarians. I think Ben's larger point really is how do you find the authentic source? How do you know that what you're looking at has validity, legitimacy, has been tested, is trust, you can trust it? I think that it's an extraordinarily important question. And frankly, you know, the New York Times a little while ago had a comparative thing on a full page. Which thing are you reading do you think comes from a reliable source and which is illegitimate, which came from a Russian troll, essentially? And I'm telling you, it was really difficult to be able to recognize it. The thing that was key was the misspellings by the troll, but that's not very good. But to raise the point about how do you know what you're looking at has legitimacy, I tend to think that professional associations are a fairly good source for double-checking something, because that's what governs the professions themselves. And people are not members of those associations unless they have the credentials and the responsibility and have acknowledged their commitment to those principles. So that's one thing. When it comes to medical knowledge, I mean, basically you use the major medical sources, whether it's Memorial Sloan Kettering or WebMD, and a couple of those that have established their legitimacy. But, you know, as far as going to a public library and actually finding a person that can help you do that, you know, libraries are, fortunately, they're at least in New Jersey, they're funded by a requirement on all municipal government budgets, so they at least get something. But they're cutting back at every level, and I'm afraid that a lot are cutting back on resource support, and I think that's unfortunate. But I think it's a good thing to raise, Ben, with your local library, what substitutes for that person behind the desk in the resource section now? Because we need to have that, and the community needs to know how to go about doing it. So some sources to be suggested, even put on a poster board in the library, might be a good way to begin. And as for human beings being 100% objective, you couldn't be more right. But I think people are also demanding from experts that they have 100% certitude on something in order to believe it. And we're never going to achieve that, and if we do, we may not recognize it if we did. I mean, I think reasonable figures, I said this earlier, if you have a 97% rate of success with a vaccine, that's pretty convincing. You don't have to wait for 99.9% in order to figure this is something I ought to do. I ought to vaccinate my child. So I think the need for certitude when it doesn't exist and recognizing what's a reasonable level of acceptability, that's something important for people to understand. It is, and all life is very complex, but if we get a sense as to how we can navigate that world, I think we're going to be on more firm footing.
Linda, we have just a couple minutes, so
sure.
I wanted to ask you one last question. Overall, are you optimistic that the situation is going to improve anytime soon?
Well, I think it may improve when the polarizing politics improve. I think it's gotten worse under those circumstances because people are so angry, they're looking for targets everywhere. But I think overall, I tend to agree with President Obama about that arc, that we are actually moving toward a progressive future. And I think that part of the great progress in the last 100 years, much of it has been driven by academic research and by the education of engineers and doctors and artists and lawyers in our academic institutions. And I think that with those who have also been trained in the professions and in plumbing and trucking and all the other essential services that are done in this nation, we will get our act together and recognize where we can find the most valuable expertise. I don't think it's going to be easy, and I think there are going to be people against it because their conflicts get in the way. But I'm hoping that optimism will win out over personal greed and that we'll return to being what I think is the open and tolerant and a nation that wants to explore and to learn and to live well.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us. Linda Stamato is the co-director of the Center for Negotiation and Conflict Resolution and a facility member at the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. She was with us to talk about ways to build more trust between the public and academia.